Hello and welcome to Dialect. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Stokes Croft, thriving hub, or is it stage managed? And also, Elia Pablo's Tech Roundup. Plus our weekly news update with Jason Yannakopoulos. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733, and I'll repeat that detail at the end of the show. But I'm joined first this week by Simon Lewis from Stokes Croft area. He's the former chair of the Ashley Forum and also still chair of the Montpellier Residence Group. Hi, Simon. Welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony.
First of all, Stokes Croft as a place to live, what's it like? Because many of us pass through it and think, well, this is nice, it looks pretty, but I don't know if I'd like to live here.
It's a lovely place to be. It's got a lovely vibe, but it really is very dirty, very filthy. We get a huge amount of foot traffic, and at the moment foot traffic and cycling traffic is just going up and up. The amount of people coming off the trains, walking through the neighbourhood, not just revellers on their way home on an evening, but also commuters now choosing to walk and cycle to work. There's an awful lot of rubbish comes our way.
Well, it's also used as a cycle route massively, isn't it? It seems to be a kind of one of the major cycle arteries of the city when the commute's coming in. A lot of people live in Montpellier, actually, rather than walk in, they'll cycle in. A lot of them maybe live further up Gloucester Road area, sort of Cottam area. I know one of the things that amazed me about you, Simon, is that you're actually growing vegetables. And even though you're doing it on the roof, how do you do that? Because for most of us, you've got to have an allotment at the very least.
Bristol Green Roofs I've been doing for 10 years now is green roofing, and it's become quite mainstream, quite systemized now, and the mainstream approach is to use a substrate and a sedum, which sort of flowers once a year. It's very dull. I'd rather be providing advice on how to create great pollinator habitats, and what I did with my own roof garden was I wanted to really push the limits, so I decided with consultation with my neighbours to put my greenhouse up on top of my workshop, I can put a Sherman tank to carry on top of it. It'll hold a huge amount of weight. And I made all my own soil. Actually, that's composting hemp and lime, which is something else I do, because that's the carbon-sequestering wall insulation that I've been pioneering. And so I made all my own soil. And I have a fantastic pollinator habitat on my rooftop vegetable garden.
We're in the middle of summer now, so have you had any crops out yet? You know, things like maybe fruit, that kind of thing. Is anything happening up there?
I've put some more fruit trees on this year. So I had an apple tree last year given to me, and then this year I've put some espaliers in. So I've got cherry, plum, got a nice Bramley apple. So I've got some nice espaliers going around the perimeter. We still are in the middle of quite a dry period. I'm waiting for rain. I've got my irrigation system set up for feeding the trees now, and I can actually leave my pump running to do that. But I've been harvesting all the things that have been coming off the roof, so all the herbs I've been drying, air drying them, and then processing all of those. I get plenty of salads, lots of herbs, and I'm also now planting in new stuff ready for the winter. So I grow lots of things like parsley and chives and things.
Well,
like
look, I haven't got a hat on, but I take it off to you anyway, because one of the things I love to do, and I feel like I have to do at the end of the week here in Bristol, is actually get out to get a bit of countryside. And it seems to me what people like you are doing is they're actually able to bring that living countryside back into the city a little bit more. I mean, I know, for example, if you go to the continent, you'll find actually livestock quite a lot in the cities, chickens, hens, even pigs and things like that. In Belgium, I've been, that's one of the things I'd love to see a bit more of. You know, come on, let's have a little bit of life in the city.
It is recreation. I mean, having a tiny little backyard, and yet I can get up on the rooftop there. I've got fantastic aspect. I get really, really good sunshine, which means that my growing season's longer. But I've got recreation, and recreation is absolutely priceless. It's good mental health. Is not only just being able to see a green roof or just a window box, but participating in it. Do come and take a look. It is open for Bristol Green Doors on the 12th, 13th of September is the next official open day, so I'm holding that the garden open that day, but by appointment, look me up online.
Okay, now I said to at the beginning that you used to chair the Ashley Forum, and I know you were sort of, I think, elbowed out of that is probably the best way to put it, but what was the Ashley Forum? What is the Ashley Forum? Isn't it some sort of somewhere between the people and the council? That's the idea, is it?
I think you remember when we decided to directly elect a mayor, he explained that he wanted to hand over more, devolve more power to the people. And I think the process for that was to actually, is through the neighbourhood partnerships. Now, the neighbourhood partnerships are where residents sit on those groups, are a consistent voice, and decisions are made. The local councillors have to vote and agree on financial issues. However, it's all done in front of the residents, so everything is quite accountable. So it is about getting people involved. In fact, when I stood myself as a candidate, I was standing on the idea of getting more participation. So the way the partnerships work is that's there to act as a conduit into the council, and feeding into the partnerships, they cover three wards, and so Ashley East and Lawrence Hill neighbourhood partnership is my district, and one of those areas was Ashley, which is made up of St Werburgh's, St Paul's, St Andrews and Montpellier, and so that would be the local forum, which then acts as an information both ways, so we can invite officers down to speak on specific issues, inform people about things, and I suppose as a chair of the residents group in Montpellier, that's been my role, is to act as that conduit between the residents and the council.
Okay, and you say you stood as a candidate. So you actually, yes, not for mayor, I take it, as a councillor.
Oh, next time. Yes, I stood. Your good friend Dave talked me into it. It was my 40th last year, and I decided to celebrate by being talked into standing for the birthday party with Dave Dobbs.
Okay, so what is the birthday party?
No idea. I asked Dave. I got no idea. Dave would probably could best answer that.
If you're standing as a candidate, haven't you got to put some kind of manifesto out?
I did put a manifesto together as such, as my own personal. I mean, Dave stands on the principle of water, the great floods coming from Mars and whatever. I stood on the principle of crowd wisdom. I wanted to express it's a bit of a sort of none of the above type, but also promoting getting people involved in hustings and voting. So I basically wanted to encourage people to vote.
Because there's a tremendous amount of apathy, isn't there? A lot of people, in some ways, you can understand it, say, well, most of the major parties have got the same sort of policies, foreign policy, economic policy, so what's the point?
Quite well. I mean, we've got nearly 500,000 people in Bristol, and about just over 30,000 voted for our mayor.
It's not a mandate, really, is it?
Not really. I mean, I stood on the principles of crowd wisdom. It's the story of guessing the weight of the village cow, and I use the analogy of a jar of sweets. And I did this at the school fete. My nephew goes to the school in St Paul's, and we got a jar of sweets, and we asked everyone to guess how many sweets were in the jar. And then if you get the more people that have a guess, you then add up all those guesses. Even them out, so you divide them by the number of guesses.
The averages, yeah.
That's right. You take an average of all those guesses and you will actually get the right answer. And I've done this several times. So if you start off with three or four guesses, a bit inaccurate, but the more you get, they even each other out. The lunatics that think there's 10,000 sweets minus the ones that think there's only two. And all of a sudden you get what is called crowd wisdom.
And it sounds to me, I've heard something along the lines, maybe sociological, forced multiplication. As soon as you've got more and more minds actually acting on a particular problem, trying to solve it, you find that the solution can come in microseconds. But the thing is, bringing those people together, and it seems what so much of our society does nowadays is tries to atomise people into little units here, there and everywhere without bringing them together. I mean, you look around the city, the number of pubs that are, you know, closing, these kinds of spaces where people used to congregate being turned into these kind of mini Tescos everywhere.
Well, I was at a meeting last night with residents just talking about a pub in my neighbourhood that might be closing down. I actually went and spoke with the planners this morning and discovered that when a supermarket chain applies to change a pub into a little convenience store, they're actually bringing it down through the classification, which makes it easier to do. On crowd wisdom, Tony, I think that not only the principle of standing on crowd wisdom, but also how we run our town. We do have the ability to have a very, very very, very clever way of running a town. By getting all of Bristol involved in decision making, we could get nearer the truth, and that's the opportunity that's being missed.
Well, if you talk to politicians in the city, as I do on Fridays, give my other show a plug, the politics show on the Friday, 5 till 7, is what they'll tell you is that actually what's happening now, the mayor is here, is that they're getting less answers when the councillors that are there are going to committees questioning things. For example, they're sitting looking at an empty chair because the mayor is too busy to be at all these meetings, he's doing other things, and they're finding that actually they're getting less answers than they used to before. There's also changes to the way that the committees work, where you can only ask questions to items that are on the agenda. You can't ask general questions in that area of the city's operation. And that one of the things that the mayor's been doing, or his officials, is when there's an embarrassing issue coming up on the agenda that they don't want to answer the questions of, they just remove it from the agenda. And then the chairman says, this isn't on the agenda anymore, you can't ask any questions about it. So we're starting to move from a democratic system into quite an autocratic system.
Very much so.
So what are your thoughts about how things have gone in the last couple of years of having a mayor? I mean, given that he doesn't really have a mandate, there's only very few people voted for him.
I bump into George all the time, and very nice chap he is too. However, I don't really like the way in which he's running this town. The last thing he did for me was I asked him if he would play a cameo in our Christmas panto on Pixon Street, and he very graciously turned up. Well, to be honest, I think he turned up to the opening of Envelope, really. He does like the publicity. Meanwhile, as you say, he is eroding power. He's taking power away from the citizens of Bristol. I like to go to full council. I'll be there next Tuesday. There's a demonstration at 5 o'clock on College Green, because there's been this petition of no confidence. And of course, it means nothing. We have absolutely no power at all. But I'd like to remind Mayor Ferguson that we voted for someone that was going to devolve power to us through the partnerships.
Well, he was also apparently going to be have the ear of the Prime Minister. He was going to be up at Downing Street all the time, batting for Bristol. That's just not happened.
It's just not happened. Actually, he's got his own agenda. He is not asking Bristol citizens. I've been very, very active in the residents parking discussions. You know, I organised a big public meeting last April, before last, when it all started. I had 280 residents turn up at that. And, you know, it was kind of almost 50-50 in the room. But we had the information to hand as to what would win people over. Meanwhile, we were told that he was listening, but actually he would never come and meet with us. He would never actually hear our ideas. We don't have we don't have a commuter parking problem. We have a residence parking problem. We need to reduce the number of car ownership in our density in a city area. And we've got loads of really, really creative ideas on how to do that and how we could reclaim our pavements and sort out our bins. And I've been building little recycling centres in Montpellier that are being very popular with those that live in flats. And we'd like car share schemes. The idea that residents that are actually sharing a vehicle between multiple addresses would like a little bay that says, we're sharing a car. You could reward people. There's all these wonderful ideas that are coming forward and they're not being heard.
Well, yeah, hang on a minute, because the mayor can't be everywhere at once. I mean, this is one of the things that's happened with the system. Concentrating power into one person is that there's a tremendous amount of demands on his time.
I welcome speaking to anybody. I've had some really, really good conversations with officers, but I'm often led to believe their hands are tied. We've got a one size fits all. It's already been decided, and it is not a dialogue. And yet, I reckon if you asked Bristol residents those really important questions, we could get some really, really creative answers. We could use that crowd wisdom. We could have the big debate about traffic and transport, and we could participate, and as such we'd have a sense of ownership. And I think you could easily get people on board with a parking scheme or a new approach to transport policy if you ask the right questions and you get people to participate in creating it, and then we'd have something that actually worked. What we're having imposed on us is not going to work. It's going to cause chaos. It's certainly, I think certainly in my neighbourhood we're going to be oversubscribed. We need to get there from here.
Whole thing just about making money? It seems to me that there's a opportunity for making money, which has happened largely in London. Think through things like the congestion charge. The fact that people are being stuffed into smaller and smaller amounts of space means that there's bound to be less room for people to park. And this is seen as a kind of pound signs appear in the eyes of these big public are actually run by the public, but they do a lot of public work. People like Capita, these big public sector private companies that come in and they say, well, we can run your parking scheme and make a fortune out of it. And I think that's what many people across the city, particularly around St Paul's, many of whom, you know, they can barely afford to own a car, let alone pay any extra for the right to actually be able to park near their home, that this is being seen as a kind of a way of making money for the city council. And of course, in future years, you may get your first pass for whatever it is for 50 quid, but every year it's going to be ratcheted up and up and up like another tax.
Yes, I personally won't be buying a parking permit. I own a garage. My vehicle doesn't fit in the garage, but I'm entitled to park outside of it. They want to put double yellows outside of it, and I'm reminding them that I don't want them to. And everyone should remember that. We might see more people putting in driveways so they can do the same. There are so many ways of cheating this system because it's not very well thought through.
Okay, so do you think that's going to happen quite a lot across the city? Is small front gardens are going to be demolished so that people can put their cars there?
I think this is what happens when you don't boil the frog. I think that as a revenue, maybe that's a great revenue. If we've got to finance stuff, where I've got these massive cutbacks, I'd like to see this money going into funding youth clubs or whatever.
But is it going?
But certainly not funding propaganda on certain Sundays of the year. That's not what I want this for. But I'm interested in how we get.
But that's
there
not
here.
Really fair, Simon, is it? Surely you're saying when the mayor does something good that everybody likes, you're saying, oh, he's only doing it for propaganda purposes.
We used to run street parties and we had no money at all. In fact, the street parties that I ran and the markets and stuff that we did, they made money. I could sell mulled cider on a cold winter's evening, and it's like shooting fish. And we did £2,000 for the children's hospice one year. So our street parties, and because what the social cohesion that came out of it was about people coming together to make something happen. It wasn't the product; it was the process. It was the lost bits of Tupperware and the meetings beforehand, and the seeing, getting to know your neighbours, and figuring out how to do these things. It wasn't about the product; it wasn't about the actual event itself. Now, if you bring in an event management company just to make something happen, now we had this with our stuff. You get people just want to come down, sit in the sun in front of a band all day and have a free party. Lovely. That's nice, but there's no social cohesion in that. Actually, it was in putting it together. The
this
fact
is
that we
actually
did it with no money.
Disempowering, isn't it?
It's
really, to have somebody coming in and saying, we're organising an event in your street kind of thing. Right, okay, no, let's just facilitate space. This is one of the things I was talking about earlier with the pubs, is that there's less and less space all the time for people to come together in somewhere that's not their own home, that's maybe, just the sort of community centres. Even they seem to be, you know, more and more difficult to get access to, get space for them and afford to run libraries, you know. These are the kind of places where people can actually sit down and have a chat.
We have a problem of organising residence meetings in my neighbourhood because we don't have a public building. We get criticised if we use the organic farm shop or if we use the, you know, like a business, or if we use the someone's personal residence, because that's, oh, I don't like them, and we need a public space. I prefer to hold that in either in the Salvation Army Citadel, which is currently closed, so we can't hold meetings there. Then people complain that that's a church and that offends different types of religions, we can't have it there. Alternatively, I would much prefer to hold it in the local public house. Now, the local public houses in my neighbourhood have been very, very supportive with that. They will allow us to come along. They'll even provide us with a free cup of tea just to make sure that everyone feels welcome. But we do get, it's not supported by our local representatives, who refuse to acknowledge our meetings because they are often held in pubs. So we had one last night. We didn't hold it in the pub because it was actually about the pub. It was about the Beaufort on York Road, which has got a planning application in, understandably, to try and maximise its retail potential. I think the landlady
Horrible language. Maximise its retail potential.
I'm trying. Well, it's I'm skirting
be,
around the issue here.
It's going to be another little Tesco Express.
No. Actually, there's an application to turn it into flats. And
retail flats.
All right,
residential.
Residential. Okay. Yes. So it's an understandable. It's the way to actually get best value out of it. Hopefully, it will remain as a pub, even if it gets if its value changes due to a planning decision. But I do hope that many residents even people that want to just save pubs, you know, camera, and your listeners maybe can go to the planning portal and look up the application on the Beaufort Pub. It's 21 York Road.
That's a lovely old place, isn't it?
It's fantastic. A lovely little pub. Yeah. It's got real character because it's got this two little rooms. You know, I mean, I'd love to see it retained as a pub. It's a freehold as well. So there's two local breweries that are interested in supplying it, and maybe seeing if they could help the residents to run it, and perhaps as the residents we've got most of a stake in it, and we could maybe make it pay the best return for the current landlady who I think would like to retire.
Okay, well, back to the mayor, because he's got his great pub himself, hasn't he, in Stokescroft?
He's got quite a few, hasn't he?
The main thing, I think, when people were first aware of George Ferguson was the tobacco factory over in Southville, Bedminster, but the canteen has become quite a feature of Stokescroft, hasn't it? I mean, I can remember that used to be, I think, many years ago I looked into it, a Christian Science church, which was then knocked down to make way for the office block, which then was empty for many years. So at least something which was an empty office is now thriving, because it just seemed to be quite busy as a pub, doesn't it?
Well, it seemed to have been left empty by the owners, which I believe are Connolly Callaghan, who are landlords to Bristol Foundation Housing. I understand that they got some people involved. I think it all began down the hub on King Street. I was involved down there a little while. They decided they were going to open up this kind of cool place. What do you call it? Startup incubator. Sounds dead cool, doesn't it? Coexist, absolutely. And however, they seem to have taken the only profitable bit. It's a bit like me running a street party and keeping control of the bar, because it brings money in. Now, the canteen isn't coexist. And everyone who goes down drinking at the canteen, it's a nice place, lovely live music, it's lovely. I like it down there. And it's selling, I don't know if anyone's noticed, it sells Bristol beers, which is great. It's a good local beer, isn't it? Brewed by the Bristol Beer Factory, owned by our mayor, George Ferguson. Likewise, the canteen has a controlling interest by George Ferguson. In fact, he seems to have a really, really good deal on business rates, both there and at the tobacco factory. And now, it's fantastic to see these places maybe supported as a startup, but I don't think they really, you know, needed support. I mean, actually, it's shooting fish. Why is it not providing money that's going back into the community projects? Actually, it's kind of been separated off. It's like they've taken the cash cow out of the. So you've got the building owner can then lease the building at a loss for, you know, not for profit, ding-a-ling, CIC. Meanwhile, the only bit that brought money in has sort of been handed over to your mates.
I mean, you could see it as a sort of public relations exercise for the mayor, couldn't you? Because, you know, obviously people don't want to think of him as a merchant venturer, which of course he was, and many people see it as a rather almost... he didn't really leave the merchant venturers when he became mayor. Although he said, if I become mayor, I will leave the merchant venturers, those nasty slave-trading capitalists who are making a fortune out of the so-called financial crisis. I thought I'd leave them. But actually, of course, he still gets invited back to merchant venturer meetings as the mayor. So, although...
He can't change his history. He can't wash his spots off.
And also he's a multi-millionaire as well. So, you know, I think there is something, for me anyway, which it seems that although he's got a very good public image, he's been very, very smart about the kind of places he's invested in the town in order to sort of provide himself with a constituency of people who are, if you want, eating out of his hand, I mean, or drinking, of course, at Stokescroft. You know, we've got a bit of a problem with city elite still, and I think George has really got to do something drastic if he's ever going to actually separate himself from that city elite, the people that own Bristol, never mind the council, the people that own the city, the people that are making a fortune out of misery of austerity going on across the country and doing very nicely out of all these Tory tax breaks.
So it's almost as if it's almost as if he might have his merchant venturer history there, but you've also got another type of Bristol elite. You've got the kind of what do you call it, the sort of the self-appointed, self-righteous, we know best. Those that don't really want to participate in a democratic process, but want to just know best.
Well, it sounds like you and I, Simon. We're sort of self-appointed, aren't
we? I'm more than happy to be criticised. I often am. It's what happens when you get on a pedestal, when you get on your soapbox. But I do like to hear what everyone's got to say and make sure that everyone gets heard. Now, a lot of what I see going on in Stokes Croft, or dare I even say at the canteen, is I see a lot of white, middle-class people that I think mummy told them they were special, and they're trying to redeem the fact that daddy's an arms dealer. Now, I don't know if they noticed, but I grow my own vegetables on my own roof. I actually know how to do it. I actually know how to install carbon sequestering, condensation-proof internal wall insulations. Bit of an aside, but this is really sort of quite tricky stuff. But they're all busy being self-appointed and being the clever ideas people, but they don't actually have any experience. I mean, they go and didn't have any direction when they got pushed off to college, so they did media studies. No offense, Tony.
Well, there's all okay. Just a little bit further up Stokes Croft, of course, we've got the Carriage Works. This dreadful eyesore, potentially beautiful building, lovely facade on the front, with Westmoreland House, that dreadful old skyscraper piece of concrete. What's the latest on that? Because, this is a running sore in the city. It'd be lovely to see if that can be sorted out. And surely, if George can sort something out, he can sort right, that one out.
I think he might be sorting out. I think he might have got his mates involved. Did I say that? Yes. I maybe should have just got some correct data or correct dates and stuff for the various meetings that are going on. I'm not able to specifically say what's happening. We've got a meeting this week because
I know the council have been threatening to compulsory purchase it, haven't they? Quite seriously, and going down.
Right.
That
okay.
Road,
let me begin back with the process. Then we're at a point of about to go into a compulsory purchase. We have selected a preferred developer. That developer was Knightstone Housing. And they have put together a range of some schemes that fit with the community vision. I don't like the word community, but there was the consultation that us as the Carriage Works Action Group and me as a member of the liaison group, we did this great consultation. We asked loads and loads and loads and loads of people through lots and lots of different means, and we found out what people wanted from the space. And then we took that vision back and we said, is this what you said? And they said yes. So we've got this great piece of real consultation. This is a real planning document. They've got a really, 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 really useful planning document. Knightstone have worked this up into a proposal, and we've got a preferred developer. All of a sudden, a new developer turns up called Fifth Capital, and they say they have a controlling interest on the site because they're liaising with the owners. Last weekend, they did a mail drop through all the doors in my neighbourhood. I don't know how far they went. They've mail shot an awful lot of people, and they put together a leaflet that is branded up in our colours of our group and all the work we've done. So it looks so. If anyone's received one of these things through their door, inviting them to a consultation, do come along. This organisation, Fifth Capital, have put together some proposals. Allegedly, I'm gonna go and take myself to the private view. I've never heard of a private view for for this sort of thing before. But
they've obviously got an event management company to do it for them.
Yeah, I think that they're called Fourth Column. we've been having some conversations with this organisation. We've been asking them some key questions, and I won't go into too much detail on that, but they've not been able to satisfy us that they're able to proceed. In effect, they don't have the money and they don't have the history, they don't have the track record.
Well, we've seen this quite a lot across the city, haven't we? Got lots of wonderful plans. Look at St Paul's, where places where people have come in and said, we're going to do a massive development. All we've got is rubble. And it's been there for something like four or five years now. There was originally a great proposal, wasn't there, for some giant tower block with a swimming pool on the top and
a bridge across the M32.
Oh, yes, probably, yes. A rope bridge or something, yes.
So, it was a green bridge, I think. It was a green bridge.
Has happened because they can't apparently raise the money. And, of course, they're using this as a way of as a sort of Trojan horse in order to say to the city council, oh, well, I'm very sorry, but we can't provide any kind of affordable housing or any kind of social housing like we used to because we just haven't got the money. Nobody, it seems, has got the money. So do you think Fifth Capital are actually going to do something? I suppose you're going to find out at this consultation, aren't you?
I certainly hope they can. I welcome anybody that can fulfil the community vision. However, they're not winning me over at the moment. I look forward to meeting up with them and discussing this. It, But I'd like to see some evidence that they can actually deliver this. And I think that it's looking like they may well just acquire planning permission, and this will put the whole process on stop and maybe lead to the site changing hands, or God knows how these things work. Certainly property development is a funny thing.
Well, one thing I noticed is quite an interesting blog online, thecarriageworks.org.uk. I don't know if you've ever posted anything on that particular blog site, Simon.
I think that might actually be our Carriageworks site, isn't it?
Okay.
I think there is a statement up there. You would say the date of the
One of the things I was going to point out is they say that this fifth capital apparently is going to develop this enormous, great, massive, multi-million pound, hundreds of millions of pounds development, has got net assets of £6,000.
There you go. So I should have done my research before coming in. I didn't realise we were going to discuss this, but there you go. You found it on the website. I ask everyone to go and take a look at that. So be aware of that flyer that came through your door. It's titled Community News, July 2014, and it looks like it's come from your neighbourhood community action group for the Carriageworks, and it's not. It's come from
the
capital.
That is pretty naughty of them, isn't it? Anyway, so who knows who these... whether these people are going to be actually doing very much. But £6,000 as their net assets, well, I don't know if they're really going to be up to the job. We shall see. You can't talk about Stokes Croft area without talking about homelessness, because it's one of the places that the homeless do gravitate towards, because a lot of the services which are supposed to help homeless people are there. I mean, what are your thoughts?
There,
quite a lot of hostel places seem to have closed, don't they, recently?
Yeah, it feels as if we're about to spend a lot of European money on doing some eco-schmeco refits on houses sort of a bit further out of Bristol that probably won't do any good and probably cause a lot of damp problems. But that's an aside. And then we can maybe move the economically inactive from our inner cities maybe out to these, because all that building work's probably going to, you know, cause the current residents to sort of a lot of stress. And then we can move the economically inactive out of our inner cities, and then maybe we could these social landlords could then probably sell on these nice shishi inner city properties at quite a reasonable profit.
Gentrification, I think they call it, don't they?
Oh, that's a good word. Yeah. So I love living where I live because it is a mixed neighbourhood.
Isn't it lovely? I totally agree with you, yeah.
And I got recently, I got accused of gentrification by someone because we were, we've been organising, picking up the rubbish, sorting out the tagging, you know, all the dog poo, all that kind of thing. Now, look, I come from a good, honest, working class family, and people used to clean their front doorstep. You know, we didn't have this what would you call the modern society that has this sort of throwaway attitude and this selfishness that leaves rubbish in the street and dog mess. And so I'm trying to keep my neighbourhood clean and safe. While we see people playing on Park Street, that weekend I was out picking up needles in my street. You know, my streets are not safe for our children to play in. And that's not gentrification, trying to make a place nice and clean and tidy. However, seeing certain people being moved out of the inner cities while we create a sort of a walking, cycling university town, that to me would fit your word gentrification. I think it seems to be we don't want the... we don't want a mix of people. We don't want plumbers.
Well, I think that's one of the most lovely things about Montpellier. You've got some really, really swanky places. You've got also very high-end joints like this that I can't even remember the name of it, at the bottom of York Road. A really expensive restaurant. There's a restaurant there. Along with, you know, some just private rented places.
The kebab shop.
You know what?
The
it's a bit like a bit like Notting Hill in London. I think, you know, Bristol's equivalent of that kind of mix of the very top of society, very bottom of society, mingling in, chit-chatting in the local shops, and that's the great thing about it.
Will it become Notting Hill? Will it become Bristol's Notting Hill?
Will it become?
I mean, I don't.
Hugh Grant,
yes,
wandering around.
That's me.
Simon Lewis, the former chair of Ashley Forum, also chairing still Montpellier Residents Group. Fantastic. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined by Jason Yiannakopoulos now. Hi, Jason, for our news review.
Hello, Tony.
Lots of news this week, at least a reshuffle. Is it a cover-up? Because it's a good day to bury bad news, isn't it, when you have a reshuffle? Everything else drops off the agenda.
It's a fantastic day to bury bad news.
Any bad news been buried, do you think, this week?
Oh, I don't know. What do you think?
Possibly the nasty little bill that they're trying to push through very fast about more surveillance. Even though it looks like the surveillance agency GCHQ are completely out of control, when they go into their little offices up in Cheltenham, there doesn't seem to be any real checks on what they're doing there at all. So what the Prime Minister seems to be doing this week and the LibCon Alliance is to just give them more power rather than to keep them in check. They're smuggling through some sort of what they call it, the DRIP bill.
The DRIP bill, great.
Data retention and investigatory powers, DRIP bill. Anyway, I think it's just a total disaster, but anyway, it'll probably go through fine.
Well, let's hope that one doesn't drip through.
Anyway, so the other news is the reshuffle. What are your thoughts immediately about some of the main points to do with the changed cabinet, if they're the people that really run the country, and I'm not sure they are? What about the new figures that we're seeing?
Well, to be honest, I had a list of at least three ministers I want to see go, and I'm glad to see that two of them have. So
who are they?
Well, Michael Gove, first of all, being shifted to Chief Whip. Come on, the most controversial Education Secretary we've ever had. Thankfully, no longer Education Secretary.
You could say controversial. You could also say utterly deluded.
Yes, I think that's what I was getting at.
The one that thought that the First World War was a righteous war and was worth fighting and all that sort of thing. Completely
bad. Only talk about British history. We don't want any other history there. God, no. No one needs to know about the Romans or the Greeks or anything like that. Oh, good Lord.
Yeah, so he's gone. Who else has gone?
Owen Paterson, the climate change denying environment secretary.
All right, and the one that went down to the Somerset levels without his wellies.
Yeah, that's the one. He's gone. He has been gone. So, surprising one, William Hague moving from Foreign Secretary and being replaced by Philip Hammond, who was the Defence Secretary.
Ah, right. Well, that's a normal move, isn't it, from Defence to Foreign Secretary? But the interesting thing is, of course, has William Hague been offered a really nice plum job in a big defence company
when he comes out of office
next year? I wonder.
I wonder.
Will we see him on the board of BAE Systems? Will we see him on the board of EADS, the big European defence conglomerate?
Probably both.
For being such a wonderful foreign secretary and banging the drum for war so much and making lots of money for these defence companies.
Philip Hammond being replaced by defence secretary. I can't recall the name of the person that's actually replaced him.
Oh, well, we'll find out a little bit later, I suppose. I know, anyway, the Huffington Post have done an article, Reshuffle 2014, six graphs that show how out of touch Cameron's new cabinet is. And these aren't really graphs. They're more like pie charts. And the first pie chart is the male and female one.
Well, I mean, there's more women in there. Surely that's a good thing, isn't it, Tony?
Hang on. Wrong. It's about three quarters male and one quarter female still.
Oh.
So no amazing revolution there in getting more women into the cabinet. Also, white versus non-white. Would you like to guess? Because there's 23 members of the cabinet.
Well, there's Sajid Javid there. So you're
absolutely right. He's the only one. He's of Pakistani heritage and the cabinet is 96% white. another thing the Huffington Post looked at is heterosexual versus homosexual. Like to guess there how many homosexual openly homosexual
Alan Duncan's in and around, but other than that I can't think of any but Alan Duncan. He's actually left the government.
Well, that's right. There are now no openly gay people in the cabinet.
Well, there you go.
Whereas the Whitehall estimated in 2006 that around 6% of the UK population, as much as 6% of the UK population were openly gay. So that's not really representing people either. How about schooling? Comprehensive versus non-comprehensive schooling.
Well, surely if the Conservatives want to betray a more normal image. Surely there's more comprehensive people in this cabinet, surely.
I'm afraid you're wrong.
Oh, no.
There are 8 people from comprehensive schools and 15 from non-comprehensive, whereas 90% of the population is comprehensive educated. So that doesn't represent the people very well. Okay, Oxbridge or non-Oxbridge?
Oh, now, I can see how this is going now. I'm guessing that there must be a lot of Oxbridge people in there.
You guessed right.
Yeah.
14 Oxbridge and 9 non-Oxbridge people. So quite a strong majority of Oxbridge people. So that's 14 out of 23, 60%. I don't know if it actually includes Bristol University in that area. No, it doesn't. No. Anyway, also, beards versus non-beards.
This is Scotty. Surely they must have got more people in who don't have beards.
Well, both of us have rather sporting, rather wonderful beards here in the show. I don't know if you'd like to scratch it for the listeners.
Yeah, here we are scratching our beards.
We are slightly, yes. Although we're also scratching our beards at whether this new cabinet is in any way representative of the British people in a democracy. But anyway, scratch away. But
would it be in this case?
No. Only 4%. Of the cabinet are bearded. That is only one person.
Who's the one with a beard? I can't think. Oh, that's a Welsh. That's a new Secretary of State for Wales.
Ah, right. Well, it's him. Jones. Yeah. So, unfortunately, I mean, I imagine he's probably been press ganged into shaving that beard immediately as part of the deal for getting his new ministerial pay. Actually, I have to say that. Well, I don't have to say anything, but I will say that also our engineer Dave Bazanko. He also has a beard. So we are almost 100% bearded on this show.
Ah, wonderful.
We'll never make it into the cabinet. Also, ought to say something about Dave's amazing visit this week. Dave, you don't normally say anything on the show, do you? But you had a visit this week from George Osborne at one of the places where you volunteer. Would you like to just tell us about what that was like?
Yeah, it was quite a strange experience. We had a visit from George Osborne. He was coming down to meet some placements from CTAC and spoke more to the younger placement there, young chap who's learning about computers and how to take computers
apart. Okay, so it's BiteBack. BiteBack is a sort of computer technology recycling. But yes. What was it actually like to meet? Did you get to shake his hand? What was he like as a person?
Yeah, he was... he's quite bony-handed to shake his hand. There were some comments that he looked a little bit more paler than he normally does.
He does, doesn't he? Always looks very pale, George Osborne. I don't know why. Maybe he just hasn't seen any sun, or maybe he's having his blood sucked by a vampire.
And also, he does seem a bit beady-eyed, doesn't he? He does seem to stare quite. Quite a lot. Have you ever noticed in his photographs? Everywhere in the media is.
My mother always says about George Osborne, says he's really the wrong person for Cameron to have in the cabinet if he wants to promote a sort of useful cabinet, because he's a public school nimby who looks like a public school nimby.
He always seems to have that orange jacket on as well. I don't know if you've seen him much on the news. He seems to appear in public with his orange jacket, which makes you think that he's some kind of part of some sort of demolition squad.
Maybe a prisoner, I don't know.
So you shook the hand of the man who's responsible for 1.3 trillion pounds of debt, paying it back. Do you think? Did you get the idea he's confidently going to do that?
Well, no.
Well, anyway, it's great. I think it's lovely, actually, in a way that people at BiteBack get to meet him. You know, because it's one of those wonderful little organisations in the city that recycles. You can get cheap computers there and that sort of thing. Do you want to just tell us a little bit briefly, Dave, about that as well?
Yeah, they'll be restarting a computer reuse scheme. The computers themselves will be available for around about, I think, £70. And they'll come with Windows 7, flat screen monitor, and a year's warranty, I was told.
Well, that's pretty good. At least they're getting recycled. So if you've got an old computer hanging around the house, sitting out in the yard or whatever, make sure you can do it, definitely, Jason. Make sure BiteBack get it, because they'll make good use of it. And even if it's using it to put a webcam on George Osborne and spy on him, maybe, you know, who knows. Anyhow, on to Private Eye, Jason, before we finish. And we've got a few stories from there. The Global Law Summit's been taking place. Now, this, I imagine, is some kind of, loads and loads of lawyers getting together, which was any excuse for a party. The lawyers seem to
like. You'd be wrong. Oh. This is to mark the 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta next year. Chris Grayling's Ministry of Justice will be hosting the first ever UK Global Law Summit, no less. International leaders in law will be brought together to commemorate and celebrate and debate 800 years of legal history. But some of the people who are going, you might not think are interested in freedom and justice. The summit chairman is Sir David Wootton, former Lord Mayor of London, who has been scouring the world for sponsors. And so far, much of the financial interest in him seems to be coming from Qatar and China.
Oh, dear.
Don't
tell me Bahrain and Saudi Arabia are leading workshops on how to use the law to oppress the people.
It's funny because one of the other people on there is, Henry Bellingham MP, who, along with Sir David Wootton, has sort of given opinion to the government that senior Kazakh leadership, this is Kazakhstan, which is another dictatorship, senior Kazakh leadership is both business and a government of high standards. He also gushed in a recent interview, there is a clear vision of what is required. And as for Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, which you mentioned, Sir David Wootton said that the Foreign Affairs Committee should be looking more positively towards the Gulf region, and with especially those two regimes showing a greater understanding.
Well, I know in the French version of Private Eye, they say this conference is being hosted by a government which is run by paedophiles.
Yeah.
In the French version of Private Eye, that is. Anyway, not in that Private Eye, because that would be terribly libelous to say that sort of thing. Anyway, PFI incinerators. Incinerators, not necessarily a good thing if you're living next to them. Quite nasty, toxic. But a PFI one sounds even worse, because it means the public's getting fleeced as well.
Yes, I'm afraid so. I mean, this is the waste department, I suppose. I don't know what part of government that's actually in. It's provoking the same concerns as such as health, because it's every bit as capable of throwing away taxpayers' money. In this case, Private Finance Initiative have built environmentally suspect incinerators since the 1990s to meet European targets to reduce the use of landfill sites. In the meantime, targets technology have changed significantly, and the idea of signing up for 25-year contracts for new incinerators to spew CO2 into our atmosphere. And all in PFI is at an extortionate cost.
Oh, no.
Already other countries in Europe already have vastly improved waste sorting technologies and are actually calling for more waste to be exported to them, because they use it to power.
They use it to generate power, electricity.
So the fact that we're sat in this country, not with this technology, by the way, and also using Private Finance initiatives to build these incinerators, which environmentally suspect, is not great news.
Now, we can't end before we just mention briefly, very briefly, Jason, half a minute, Barclays, what have they been up to? Because I know I do find the banksters most annoying people in the whole of society. I do think that most of them really should be behind bars, although they probably should have a proper court case first. But so what's this?
This one goes back from 2006. The Rochester-based Port Medway Marina was a successful and expanding boat mooring and repair business, following with a three-stage development plan by the following year, was on track, with planning permissions obtained and, of course, being financed by Barclays. However, as a credit crunch bit, Barclays refused to extend credit to Port Medway and they had to find alternative lenders. The only snag was that in 2006, the company, Port Medway, signed an interest rate swap, which is actually completely illegal, meaning that they had to pay an extra £200,000 just to get out of the deal they originally had with Barclays.
Oh, right. Well, interest rate swaps, yes, another crooked thing that the bankers do, along with foreign exchange, PFI, and also PPI insurance, and LIBOR fixing. So they're up to it all, but none of them go to jail. Anyway, thank you very much for a news review. We'll hear next week. We'll have a review on Palestine and what's been going
Indeed.
On there. Thanks very much, Jason.
It's a pleasure, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
It's Jeffrey Sparks. It's the What's On Guide. Jeff, what's on this week?
Thank you, Tony. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday 18th of July, the Rammstein tribute, Ramlied, will be performing with support from Cerda Pavonis at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7pm. Also on 18th of July, the AC/DC tribute, Hell's Bells, will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. On to Song of the Week, and I present the Sex Pistols. This group formed in 1975 in London and split in 1978. In that time they released one album and they initiated the punk movement in the UK. Since splitting in 1978 they have had numerous reunion shows, including this one from 1996, which spawned the album Filthy Looker Live and included this song, Pretty Vacant.
We're the Pistols, no one likes us, and we don't care.
Sex Pistols with Pretty Vacant from the album Filthy Looker Live. Moving into Saturday 19th of July, the Psychedelic Warlords will be performing with support from Electric Cake Salad and also Jupiter's Carnival at Louisiana in Wapping Road, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. Finally on Sunday 20th of July, Area 11 will be performing at the Exchange in Old Market, Bristol. Tickets are £11 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks, Jeff. Sorry, no time for Elia this week, but she'll be with us next week. That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast, Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guest Simon Lewis and also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. And at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now. I'm not going to do that.
Sorry about the the reverential delay there. I was I dropped a pound coin on the floor and was underneath the desk trying to reclaim it when the record ended. My goodness me, chest pains, all that exercise, good lord. Anyway, what did I just play you? That was Mammal and Tanuga, and that's on Pyramid Records from the compilation of the Chakra compilation, Return to the Source.